This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Bound to happen, bound to spread. Hawaii Public Radio has learned of a recent discovery of the dreaded little fire ant at Kualoa Ranch, a popular tourist destination on Oahu's windward side. Kualoa's president and general manager, John Morgan, talked with us this morning about how he believes it got there and what's being done to curb the infestation.
We have a lot of things going on at Kualoa Ranch, and stewardship is one of them. We had a goal to kind of restore one of the small little valleys on the ranch that was overrun by invasive species, java plums, this, that, the other thing. And so we were working with Huyo Ko'olaupoko, a great not-for-profit, obviously in Ko'olaupoko, the windward side, to get a grant to kind of clear, a couple acres and basically plant native plants in there. So we did that, and over the years, we've been maintaining it and everything. And back in April, our staff was in there doing some maintenance work and noticed that they're getting some bites. And so it turned out that we had some fire ants that were part of this native plant restoration effort that we were doing. And so that was the restoration effort started in 2012, and we discovered this just this year.
So you try to do a good thing and something bad happened.
Occasionally that happens. And so, that's unfortunate, but that's what happened exactly.
Well, because you have so many people that go through your property, and I don't know what the total acreage is of the ranch, but can you explain to our listeners where this find is, and have you been able to determine how large of an area the infestation is covering?
So the whole ranch is just under 4,000 acres. It's three different ahupua'a, hakipu'u, kualoa, and ka'ava. So 4,000 acres, top of the mountain, almost to the ocean in a lot of places. So this was a relatively small area, just a couple acres in that we had fenced off so that we could plant these native plants and keep the cows and other ungulates out of it, ungulates being pigs. So it's a very relatively small area, less than 0.5% of the ranch.
When I checked with the Ag Department, they were saying that you folks were still assessing the boundaries. So you think it's less than 2 acres?
Yeah, we called up the Department of Ag and Oahu Invasive Species Council and notified them immediately. And they were very good to send out teams. Actually, I think it's on four different occasions to determine how far these things had spread. And we went ahead, ordered some basically insecticide. So eradication is our goal. We didn't want to wait on anything. We just So we're going ahead and trying to get rid of this as fast as we can. From what we understand, people are not the vectors. We have workers that have gone in there in the past and weeded, because that's what you have to do in a native plant restoration area. But as far as our visitors and things like that, we have a road that goes next to the area, but we don't think that kind of thing is spreading it, and people are not spreading it from what we understand.
Okay. All right. But, I know it's not publicity that you really want, but you want to contain this ASAP.
Yeah. We feel that, like a lot of things, if something's happening, we'd rather not have it all get out there, but it is happening, and we're not, interested in hiding anything, but we just want to do the right thing. We want to do the right thing for... it's a nasty little insect, and we'll do everything we can to contain it and control it and eradicate it, working with the Department of Ag and Oahu Invasive Species.
Okay, but basically the visitors to the valley back there then are pretty much kept away from that area. You're able to isolate it.
Yeah. We're working closely with them. Again, they didn't come out with protocols on things, and so we just don't think we didn't want to wait. It's one thing to st- study it. It's another thing to do something, and I guess we're impatient and we wanted to get ahead and start to, you know, to do, you know, treatment. How do you do a rapid response and actually, you know, start to get rid of these things? And we've heard that you know, treatments are effective. And so as we talk, I'm not, you know, exactly sure of the life cycle and all of that of the fire ants, but we're confident working with our partners that we'll be able to control this thing.
The ag officials were saying that they were successful in eradicating it in Mililani, and then there was also the find at Huimanu recently, or earlier this year, where you had those, I think, about a dozen properties area is under treatment. And with my limited knowledge, yeah, it has something to do with, you know, having the bait stations and then having the worker ants bring back
to the queen,
the
insecticide, exactly,
to the queen. And so hopefully then it's just going to be a matter of time.
Of course, you know, monitoring is the key to determining how much. But, you know, again, treatment is vital.
And then when will you be meeting with the ag folks again?
Taylor Kellerman, our Director of Stewardship and Agriculture, I think is in constant contact with them.
I know they did have a program with the U.S. Department of Agriculture when it came to the beetle. They had a rapid response team, and, you know, they have traps set out, and there is a regular crew that goes out to check those traps because, you know, they're all over. There's just, I think, thousands of those traps. With the little fire ant, I guess it's a little different because, you know, we've only had these isolated cases, but it is a concern as a pest.
Yeah, no, and we have actually been working with them from before we found this to do basically annual surveys for LFA. They call little fire ants the acronym LFA. So we've been doing annual surveys prior to the discovery with the Oahu Invasive Species Council.
Okay, and then will you be doing anything just to kind of notify residents or visitors to the ranch just about the efforts that you're undertaking? No plans at this point.
There's no threat to anybody's health or safety, so we don't think that's necessary.
Okay. All right. I mean, I know that's a concern that it might hurt business, but you are taking efforts in to make sure that this area is isolated.
Yeah, we've been of the understanding that it's not transmitted by water or by vehicles or by people, and so again, trying to assess risk, and if there's no threat to health and human safety and anything, you know, that's what we're operating under, that assumption.
That was John Morgan talking about the recent find of little fire ant at Kualoa Ranch. The news came as a result of recent call-in shows on The Conversation about invasive species and what's been bugging you this summer. Coming up, we'll learn more about a large infestation of coconut rhinoceros beetle at a city facility and hear from state agriculture officials about these latest finds. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's quiz, we're turning our eyes to the sky. Hawaii is one of the most isolated areas in the world, and at their closest points, Hawaii and California are 2,238 miles away from one another. But that distance has gotten smaller and smaller as jet craft make the trans-Pacific journey more accessible. Now, there are some between 30 and 40 flights scheduled from California to Oahu each day, but it all had to start somewhere. Paradise of the Pacific documented the first nonstop civilian flight between California and Oahu in 1927, more than 90 years ago. Inspired by Charles Lindbergh's flight from New York to Paris, James D. Dole offered a prize of $25,000. In today's dollars, that's about $268,000. And he offered that prize to the first pilot to cross the finish line in his overseas air race. Five pilots took off from Oakland Airport in California on August 16, 1927. Only two landed the next day near Honolulu. For today's quiz, we want to know the name of the pilot who landed first to claim his prize money. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, celebrating 90 years, offering nonstop service with seat selection to 13 North American cities, now including Boston. Reservations at hawaiianairlines.com.
A couple of hundred, now maybe a couple of thousand. Well, we're talking about the invasive beetle, the coconut rhinoceros beetle that Oahu has been trying to curb following its discovery at Pearl Harbor Hickam several years ago. Dr. Po Young Lai is the city's point man for this latest discovery. He talked to us earlier this morning.
For the site at the Waiawa Row, it was found in April of this year. And then when they found it, this is Department of Agriculture, they have a cruise. Went around and they found the infestation, and that infestation actually, the site was people had dumped the wood chip and some other green waste on the city property, and that served as a breeding ground for the rhinoceros beetle. And so at that time when they found, they called me on April 16th. And immediately, we took the action. And the mayor and the MD saying that we have no silo. And this is exactly what happened here. We work with the I become coordinator for the action here with the Department of Land Management, also Department of Facility Management, and then also Environmental Service, the EMV. So we got together, and then everybody tried to pitch in, being a good partner with the Hawaii Department of Agriculture.
So what was this site? It was just a property owned by the city that someone was using as an illegal dumping ground?
Yes, that's owned by city, and apparently used to be the waste treatment site there. And so the neighbor across the street, row dumping the green waste on that, and that become a problem.
Okay, so what's adjacent to this area?
It's in the residential area. The next door, the neighbor was all housing area. Behind the LCC, Leeward Community College.
Okay, is that near the area they call Banana Patch?
They're not too far from the bicycle path. Remember we had the cleanup once.
Yes. Yeah, I recall that. Was this just discovered in one of the traps that was set out?
No, it was found because there was some breeding material there, and so the Hawaii Department of Agriculture, they have the beetle, the rhinoceros beetle crews. They went around and they found the beetle infesting the breeding in there.
Okay, so what have we done since April?
Okay, so we continuing that manually try to rake it while we try to. I work with Department of Ag continuously and try to find out what would be the best action to take. Okay, and after talking about fumigation, and because this beetle is a big beetle. And if you use the fumigation, the dosage will have to be much higher than compared to the small beetle like rice weevil or something that infests in the grain. So we don't have any research data to see how much it requires to kill the beetle, use the fumigant. And so we tested that, but if later found out that it's not the the best option.
Okay, not effective.
So the best option is to use we have the so-called MERIT, the granular insecticide. And that granular insecticide, it just sprays like a fertilizer. And then we're coming with the water to spray that. And so that dissolve the granular so they will seep into the breeding material. And because we're concerned about the potential, there's a stream right next to that, the site. So we make really cautiously not to have anything that water will be leached into the stream. Yeah.
What about the option of just like removing some of that green waste matter, if it's mulch or whatever it is?
Eventually we will. And so this will be the first phase of mitigation, and using the insecticide, the so-called MERIT, and then spray with water, and then let the temperature, and then we till it, and heaping the material to make it a compost for the temperature to build up. And by building up the temperature, that will kill those beetle present. Then the second phase after this, we're thinking about a month later, we're going to work with the Navy and use the Navy so-called in-vessel composting. And we're going to put all the material into just like a roll of beans. And from there, we spray it with the urea, the fertilizer, and also thermophilic bacteria, and also the Epsom salt, so that to enhance the temperature buildup. And again, that will be the last composting process to kill all the beetle. Then those material, after finished, the compost material will be hauled to the edge power for incineration.
Okay, but we have already started tilling the area then.
That's correct. Yesterday. The tilling was done yesterday.
And you have been in contact then with the Navy officials about being on guard? Because I know they've really done an incredible job in trying to beat back the beetle when it was first discovered many years ago. And I'm sure they're concerned because they don't want their property to get reinfested again.
No. So the equipment that we're going to use, borrow from Navy, will be hauled to closer to the Wayaba Road. And so that will be easily, we can, and besides, we don't want the beetle to be spreading along the way anyway. So the closer that we do the in-vessel composting will be better.
Okay, and my understanding was when the find was the discovery was made, it was just a couple hundred beetles, but it may be in the thousands, a couple thousand at least.
Yeah, right now, at the Wayaba Road, we found so far, we picked up about, not quite, about 1,500 primary larvae. Majority is a larvae and some beetle and some pupae.
Can you describe the acreage for our listeners?
The acreage is about 1,400 square feet. And that's a TMK, belong to the city. But the actual, wood chip was dumped there. It's about 7,000 to 8,000 square feet.
Okay, what's that equivalent to?
Not quite a quarter acre.
A quarter acre.
Yeah.
You mentioned it was behind Leeward Community
LCC,
College?
Leeward Community College.
Right, and that's, I think, also right up against the
Heart. No. Heart is on one end, more the Ever end, and this is more Diamond Head side.
Okay, it's more near residential homes then.
That's right.
Okay, because I do recall some discovery, it was a couple years back, in the Banana Patch area, and they were working with the particular homeowner there.
Yeah.
I think they knocked those down.
The homeowner and also some, there's a nursery. There's they're growing the nursery plant, and that was in that area too. Yes, from the city, we all the several department involved, And the Department of Facilities Management, Department of Land Management, and also the Environmental Service. And then the other side is the Department of Agriculture, Hawaii Department of Agriculture, and also the federal USDA. The three agencies, we work together very, very closely.
And why was the tilling just done yesterday? Couldn't that have been done sooner?
The tilling, because the spray was done on last Friday, okay? And the tilling, again, beside the government agency, the Coveta company voluntarily, free of charge, provide the roller tiller for us to use yesterday.
And we did reach out to the State Agriculture Department about the efforts to contain both sites. Kevin Hoffman, the administrator for the Plant Industry Division, had this to say.
We found a little fire ant on Kualoa Ranch. We had a site assessment yesterday with Casper Vanderwood from the Hawaii Ant Lab on Hilo. He's kind of the resident expert. And so he's drafting up a comprehensive treatment program. We've delimited around the initial detection. If we put in a 30-meter buffer around all the detections, we may end up treating around 20 acres total.
Okay.
And it's in an area of the ranch that there's like a it's actually between bike trails, so it's not really in an area where people end up going into, which may be one reason that it got to the level that it is right now, just because no one was going into that area and getting stung.
Okay, so you feel pretty confident that it hopefully can be contained and people can stay out of that area.
Yeah.
And what about the coconut rhinoceros beetle and what's happening with the city's property?
Yesterday we went in and basically tilled the mulch so that beetles get exposed and they end up drying out or getting eaten by birds and stuff. So that's another way to kind of knock down the population that's actually there in the pile. And then we're looking at a longer term, probably composting to actually to get the material, finally destroyed.
Right, and I guess we need to underscore to people, if you see something, report it, because the summer months, probably a lot of bug activity.
You bet, yeah. And for that, we have three ways to do it. There's the 843 pest hotline, there's a website, and there's also the iPhone app.
For links, you can head over to hawaiipublicradio.org. Wayne Wilkinson brings a high-octane jazz guitar performance filled with fast-fingered licks and cool grooves. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Amoresco. Some say it was a good idea, so why is the domestic violence safe shelter closing its doors? Well, that's the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beats reporter Yu Yun Jung on the line with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. So tell us. Now, we've been hearing about this center for some time, but the cuts are coming.
That's right. So just to give you some of the basic facts here, the Safe House opened in September of 2016, and it was under the city prosecutor, Keith Kaneshiro. And you said in the opening that it's a domestic violence shelter, but it also houses victims of sexual abuse as well. And what happened at the June 5th City Council meeting is that the City Council voted to cut off all the funding for security, which, the prosecutor says is like the big part of the budget that keeps this place open, because it wouldn't be a safe house without security.
And I know a number of the council members were wringing their hands about this during the committee meetings.
That's right. So one of them is Joey Manahan, who's also the budget committee chair. He told me that a lot of money is being spent on a program that he's not sure is doing what it's supposed to do. And he's not even sure what it's supposed to be doing. So there's a lot of confusion about what the Safe House is actually supposed to do and if they're being effective. But basically the motive, as they said it in the beginning, as the prosecutor's office has said it in the beginning, is to basically make witnesses more protected so that they would be more inclined to testify against their abusers. So that they would be convicted, right? And in that sense, you know, 14 cases involving Safe House residents led to successful convictions, and 5 were dismissed, and there's another 6 awaiting trial. So you could kind of see that without counting the ones that have not taken place yet, that would be like 14 out of 19 cases.
So, yeah, this Safe House, you know, like your article mentions, was, some say, a good idea, but... the question is it worth the money that they're spending out for the security, right?
That's right. And the city council didn't think so. And so as a result of that, you know, the Safe House is closing down at the end of August. And that would mean that 7 residents and their dependents who live there now are going to have to go find other housing options. And at least one of them has told me that she will end up being homeless again.
And this story, as I was reading it this morning, I was thinking, gosh, because of the secrecy, I mean, trying to protect a lot of the women at the safe shelter, the Safe House, you know, we can't really use their names because, you know, obviously we're trying to protect them.
That's right. But so I guess like the measures that are being taken by the prosecutor's office to keep the women at the Safe House safe have also led to some allegations against them about, you know, because now the ACLU of Hawaii has sent a letter to the prosecutor's office with allegations from some of the former and current residents of the Safe House who are saying that, you know, they were arbitrarily searching residents' apartments, and they're also subjecting them to random drug testing and trying to control who the residents can have outside contact with. So those were some of the things in a long list of allegations.
And I guess how's that going to get resolved? This place is closing down in a matter of weeks.
So one big part of that letter was also trying to stop the prosecutor's office from retaliating against residents for speaking out about these issues. So the letter was more about, stop retaliating against the residents. Of course, the prosecutor's office says that never happened.
And so big question, yeah, what happens to the women that are there? What happens about these allegations, and how does it get resolved knowing that the doors are going to shut down in August?
Yeah, I don't know if the ACLU is planning on pursuing more action in this regard, but if so, maybe those allegations could be resolved through that in the court system. But as for the other issues, I'm not sure. But at the same time, another thing that we should note is that there's also a federal corruption investigation going on, and that investigation scope includes this Safe House because it was Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro's initiative.
Right, and that was all tied to the Kealoha case, the trial that we just had a verdict in. All right, well, we'll just have to see what happens in the weeks to come. But thanks so much, Yu-Jun.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that was reporter Yu-Jun Jung with today's Reality Check. To read her story on this issue, visit civilbeat.org. A majority of the justices on the Supreme Court of the United States recently decided that it was not the court's responsibility to overturn voting districts drawn with the intent of advantaging one party or another. Partisan redistricting, gerrymandering as it's commonly known, has gotten a lot of attention in recent years. Kathy Fong, National Redistricting Director for the pro-democracy group Common Cause, sat down with HPR's Ryan Finnerty to talk about gerrymandering.
Well, to be specific, it's actually gerrymandering because it comes from Governor Gary's name, who was a governor of Massachusetts back in the 1800s during the founding times of our country, when there was a battle royale between his party and another famous figure from the Founding Father days, Patrick Henry. And the lines were drawn in such a way that they resembled the shape of a salamander, and an enterprising reporter called it a gerrymander because the lines were so distorted in order to be able to excise Patrick Henry from a seat and give Governor Gary's party the advantage. That name has stuck, but over time it's evolved into a more current way of saying it, which is gerrymander.
So this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty much since the founding days of our country.
And how is it applied in the modern world? How do we see it play out?
So what we see is that the way that redistricting is generally done is that there's a party in charge of our legislature, generally the majority party of a state. Their leaders will be the ones who control how the lines get drawn. Oftentimes, where the legislature draws their own lines, they go behind closed doors. You'll hear stories of them renting a hotel room across the street from a legislature. They'll parade individual members from their own party one by one into a secret room where somebody's drawing the lines. And then oftentimes those lines are then introduced into the legislature as a bill, and there's a rush vote to pass it along party lines. Unfortunately, when state legislatures control their own line drawing, they oftentimes will not only squeeze out the other party, but they will protect their own incumbents in a way that eliminates true choice for voters, and it eliminates the ability for challengers to come up and really give them a run for their money. And oftentimes it also can lead to corruption and non-responsive elected officials because literally, they're just elected again and again. There's nobody running against them. They've kind of cut out any challengers from their district. And so they're running without challenge, without accountability.
You know, one of the things that was interesting to me when I first learned about this, you know, years ago in high school is, why are these shapes of these districts so weird? Why is it done this way? But when you think about it, each district has to have the same number of people in it, right? Yes. And people live in all over the place.
Yeah. So it is true that I think one of the things that people react to is oftentimes the shape of the district. And sometimes the shape of the district can tell you a little bit about the motives behind why something is the way it is. In California, we had a district where a senator lived in a poorer part of the neighborhood in Los Angeles, but decided that because he had come up in the world and he now had horses stabled in a much richer neighborhood, he wanted to draw a loop that had a tail from his neighborhood that he lived in all the way to where his horses were stabled for no good reason other than he had the power to do it. And so you see sometimes these oddball shapes, but a lot of times the shapes might also track the boundaries of a city or a community, and people don't move or create cities in nice geometric square shapes. If you look at the outlines of most cities, they tend to have fingers and protrusions everywhere.
I heard of one really brazen example. I want to say it was in North Carolina, but I'm not sure where a state representative's individual home was actually like cut out of her district, and then she was not eligible for office.
That's
anymore.
Right. Certainly in North Carolina, but unfortunately, that is the case for most instances of gerrymandering. In fact, President Obama, when he was a rising star in the Illinois state legislature, he was attempting to run for a state Senate seat. And because in the first race that he'd run against somebody he'd lost, he bore the brunt of the next round of redistricting where they had carved his house out from a particular seat that he was looking to run in. And they literally just carved a one block nook out of the district exactly where his house was. So it happens quite commonly where these kinds of decisions are made to disadvantage an incumbent or disadvantage somebody from the minority party.
Well, we know now that the Supreme Court decided on a pretty narrow margin, 5-4, that it was not within the judiciary's purview to evaluate or to second guess the decisions of state legislatures that do this work. Could you give us a little bit of analysis on that decision and what the two different arguments in the case were?
Sure. Well, so what's interesting is that coming out of North Carolina, the legislature essentially was saying, yes, what we did was for partisan advantage. Yes, we did screw the other side over. Yes, we actually assigned a partisan score to each precinct, and we made decisions about how to draw those lines in order to assign voters to districts where we thought we could pick up the most number of seats. And they were unapologetic about it. And, in fact, actually, the lawyer for the state legislature said again and again, I don't even want to talk about whether or not we could create a standard or whether or not this is the right thing to do. There is no reason for the Supreme Court to weigh in on this kind of issue. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court, even after really struggling during oral arguments about the right and wrong of this, and even in the opinion, saying that partisan gerrymandering is abhorrent to our democracy, ultimately said that it was essentially not their job to step into this and to determine whether or not there was a constitutional standard by which you could draw a line and say, these are the guardrails, and outside of that, you can't go. Unfortunately, what it ultimately does is it gives a green light to a lot of state legislatures to punish dissent. We're verging on giving a green light to legislatures to behave as if they were the Politburo, to take away the ability for there to really be an adversarial system between two parties. And instead, once a party wins at the beginning of the decade, they can wipe the other side off the political map and control elections for the rest of the decade. That is leading us down a very dangerous path. And if we eliminate the possibility that there's real competition and choice in elections, we are potentially undermining one of the basic premises of American democracy.
In some states, this redistricting process is handled by an independent board or commission. Do we see better results under that system, or is it still ineffective?
I might say that I'm a little biased because I am from the state of California, and I was pretty involved in helping to create the California Citizens Redistricting Commission. And in California, because we have the initiative process, we were able to craft a law that voters passed overwhelmingly to say that a group of 14 people who don't have any ties to politicians, who don't give major money to candidates, and who aren't, you know, related in some way to the political system, were going to travel throughout the state, take testimony, and ultimately draw the lines. Even when the lines were challenged, they had a 9-0 decision to repeatedly uphold the maps because the process had been transparent. The lines that were drawn were fair. They really respected communities and city lines. And ultimately, when it all played out, there were a fairly large number of districts that could swing either way between Democrats and Republicans, because that's just how sort of those communities were kind of coming up. And from time to time, when there's a blue wave, then those seats can be captured by Democrats. And when there's a red wave, they could be similarly captured by Republicans. In my mind, that's a true definition of a democracy that's working right, where people have the ability to elect candidates of their choice.
So what plans do you have, does your organization have going forward? Now we have this Supreme Court decision. As I understand it, it does leave the door open for action at the state level still.
Yeah. There are really three different areas that we can move. One is to support states that have initiatives to continue passing those initiatives to reform the system. So we're seeing possible action in states like Arkansas, Oregon, and Nebraska. In states that don't, we're pushing for legislation. So states like Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Virginia, they're looking to amend their constitution or pass statutes that would essentially create some guardrails on the redistricting process. At the federal level, Congress is pushing H.R. 1, the For the People Act, and embedded in that, they would also require, as a bottom-line matter, that every state create a citizens' commission that meets certain basic minimums. And then lastly, litigation. So there are about 24 states that have some kind of clause within their state constitution that protects free and fair elections. And we've seen in Pennsylvania that that's been a successful way of challenging the state lines and congressional lines using the state constitution, where the decision is ultimately made by a state court and it's not reviewable by the Supreme Court.
A fight on many fronts now. Kathy Fung, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kathy Fung, National Redistricting Director for the pro-democracy group Common Cause. You can hear a longer version of the interview at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is Dr. Vivian Tam of Pacific Vision Institute. As I was growing up in the United Kingdom, I was blessed enough to enjoy marvelous public radio. When I moved to Honolulu, I was ecstatic to discover HPR. I started my own ophthalmology practice and have been a corporate sponsor since then. My patients appreciate that I support HPR, and I'm glad that I can do my part.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
For today's quiz, we wanted to know the name of the first civilian pilot to successfully fly nonstop from California to Oahu. While the trip only takes 6 hours today, it took Arthur C. Gerbel 26 hours and 17 minutes to fly across the Pacific to Wheeler Field near Honolulu. He'd flown in the Air Force during the First World War, and afterwards he made his living as a Hollywood movie stunt flyer. He piloted the Woolerock, a Travel Air 5000 monoplane. Only one other pilot survived the journey. Martin Jensen landed just 2 hours after Gerbel in his monoplane, Aloha. Coming in second, Jensen had to settle for the modest sum of $10,000 or $147,000 in today's dollars. And congratulations to Brendan Holland from Kaimuki. You got it right. And that's our backyard quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Fine dining has been on Noe Tanigawa's mind. She joins us in studio this morning to talk about what's happening on the local food scene. Morning.
Yeah, good morning. I've titled this series Eating Around because, let's face it, we all do. And this is kind of a look at Hawaii's food culture, where we're at and maybe where we're going to go. We've jumped in already with a couple of stories about Hawaii regional cuisine, HRC, and its beginnings in California cuisine, right? This move toward lighter fare using fresh local ingredients. Well, Chef Alan Wong is one of the original dozen in our first food movement here in Hawaii. KCC grad, he distinguished himself at a beloved New York French restaurant, Lutèce, before coming back and opening his own place here on King Street. He says he wants people to taste Hawaii in his food, its history, as well as the fruits from the land.
When I was growing up in the industry, you chose a place and you worked there for years and you're hoping that you learn. Today, if you want to learn how to make a dish, you go on YouTube and it teaches you anything. Problem is, when you go on YouTube, it doesn't tell you if it tastes right or not. You deny yourself the opportunity to be mentored, okay? If that's how you're learning today, you don't know how to teach. Do you need to serve dakalaranch today? Almost nobody does. But the techniques are important to learn. It's about making a gastric, incorporating fruit with protein.
Not sure I've ever done that. Chef Wong is talking about the technical skills that are the basis for cooking as an art, right? And not everybody has to cook like an artist, but those who do tend to be the pioneers for the rest of us. Alan Wong is cagey, too. He's super smart. I see him there sitting behind his desk at his restaurant. He's like a lion. His eyes are moving all the time. You want to know what was on his desk?
What?
A bag of marungai leaves.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's the new superfood, supposedly. Mm-hmm. You know, kalamungai, what's growing all over the place. What if Hawaii was famous for delicious food with augmented nutrition? Maybe, right? Well, there's a lot of ways we could do. Wong is onto this. In the 1990s, there was international buzz about our cuisine in Hawaii. People were getting interested in coming here to eat what we got. Here's Chef Grant Sato from KCC.
When we had the big three on the island, Roy before he expanded, and you had Allen and you had Mavro, they stuck to their guns and their goals, and they were pushing each other to greatness. With the advent of social media, all of the copycat artists have lost their identity focus. They are too afraid of what the world will say. Like back in the day, it was the Wong way or the highway. You do it how Alan wants to do it, or you don't associate with him at all. That's the right way, because you're getting the soul of the chef. There is an identity. When you don't have that strict rigidness in the kitchen, it's however the employee of the day wants to do it.
Strict, rigid, that's this guy mm-hmm. here, Grant Sato, award-winning KCC instructor. And he asked, now, when was the last time you really ate something you loved? See, his definition for that is you immediately want to have it again as
yes.
soon as possible.
Oh, absolutely, again and again.
Yeah. He said that happened to him first time with Naples at Zippy's. And, you know, recently I told him, I found a place I love. I've been back there 3 times in 2 weeks. Is he happy for me? No, he says, well, good. I hope it's consistently great every time. That's a test. So how do you assure consistent quality? Well, here's Alan Wong on that one.
My simple definition of cuisine is when the cooks begin to taste their own food. It always tastes. So I've reduced cooking down to 3 simple things. Number one is salt. Second thing is execution. If you're going to fry something, make sure it's crispy and not greasy. And then last is balance. If you're making something like sweet sour, your idea of sweet sour, you might be too sweet, you might be too sour. You always got to taste, you always got to eat. So if you're making a pan sauce, I might say to you, before you plate that, you give me every plate, I want to taste this food. And you start getting it, then it's every other, then every third. Eventually, I take the training wheels off, so, okay, good to go. I taste your stuff maybe once a night, two times a night.
Really?
Yeah, that's the way I am.
That is the answer to consistency. Everybody has to calibrate to him and his taste.
Interesting.
Yeah, really.
The Wong standard.
Exactly, yeah. You know, but how many people are going to go to these lengths with their employees? I mean, I heard his place called Alan Wong University for what people learn, you know, working there. He attended KCC, and a lot of KCC students have passed through his kitchen as well. If you're wondering what's up with KCC's Culinary Institute of the Pacific, you know, they do have the parking, water, gas, electrical in there. The advanced pastry lab and the restaurant are still ahead. Fundraising continues, but there are currently two cooking labs in use for the Bachelors of Art courses up there. And Chef Sato says he's looking forward to more teaching labs, loading docks, classrooms. But the whole idea is to what end? Sato wants Hawaii's unique cuisine to be a beacon in the Pacific. He wants people to come here because they gotta taste what we got.
If you look at our industry now, even though we have good chefs out there, they're all the copycat artists, which means they're trying to change their style of cuisine to what is most popular now. We have to have a new vanguard who's going to step up and basically say, hey, if you want to be a respected chef, step up in your game.
What does that usually take?
It takes someone who's going to stick to their idealisms. You have to be someone in the private sector, someone who has enough moolah to stand on your own and not worry about what other people think about you. Do it the way you want to do it and only do it that way. And if you can maintain quality doing it your way, then you're going to build followers. If you look at the top restaurants in the world, they're the best restaurant in the world, not because they've branched out or not because they're so innovative. They're the best restaurants in the world because their integrity never changes.
I really love applying these words to the food we're eating, right? Care, integrity, consistency.
Yeah, I love the line about he wants people to taste Hawaii in his food.
Yeah. I mean, Mom used to provide this stuff right at home. But, I mean, and it's not all high-end that they're talking about. Chef Sato's got his favorite L&L. And he said Market City.
Oh,
it's really good. They really care there, he says. Well, now look, if you care about food in Hawaii and maybe just want to learn more, I'm going to put the extended interview with Alan Wong on the Arts and Culture thread there on our website. And I think especially any culinary students out there, you will learn a lot. I talked to Grant Sato for about 3 hours. I think I'll cut that down before I share that with you. But we've got to have him back because he's throwing down the gauntlet and calling out the next vanguard of chefs to step up.
Well, you know, I know just with the food truck scene, you know, a lot of folks get their name and they get their following out there. And then they go on to, you know, to a storefront place.
Yes, I just talked to a KCC grad who that is his goal. He wants to start out with a food truck and really make stuff that construction guys who work hard during the day are going to love. And this is he's looking back to his own background. He's looking at, you know, different kinds of Filipino foods, local foods, stew, curry, and then he'd like to build from there.
You know, I know when I go traveling, my taste buds just get all excited because, you know, you try different foods, and I imagine that's what happens when people come here and they try our food because we have so many wonderful things like lily koi.
I know. Well, that's what's to be discovered here, and we really can entice people to visit for the purpose of tasting it. Now, what Alan Wong says is that the history of our food, of our culture, is in the food. He'd like to have a food history museum of Hawaii. That would be cool, right?
Yeah, okay. Another thing to put in the oven and bake. Okay. Thanks so much, Noe.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Noe Tanigawa tantalizing us with stories about Hawaii's top chefs as she eats around town. That's it for today. We'll be taking a break for the 4th. Capital Steps is on for tomorrow. But we'll be back on Friday to talk about short-term vacation rentals and enforcement. Are you affected by the new law that Honolulu's mayor just signed? Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Call 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back July 5th with more of The Conversation.